Welcome back to Art Matters, the podcast for artists. Back today is my guest, Anne Harris. She's a painter, a curator, a writer, and professor at the Art Institute of Chicago. On last week's episode, we talked routine, relevance, drawing, contracts and royalties, invisible labor. I could rattle off all of it, but you're better off just giving part one a listen if you haven't already. This time around, Anne speaks about Paul's Piece Goes Sour, the artist's spouse, therapy, loneliness, momentum, the zone, music in the art studio, and why painting is a vocation, not a career. Here's my conversation with the artist Anne Harris. Yeah, but you were saying about never being a big drinker, and I don't think I'm a big drinker, but you know, I absolutely I feel the repercussions of it, and I do wonder when I'm just gonna smarten up and how my time in the studio and life will just expand, you know, because there'll be whether it's sleep that gets goofed up or this or that. It's like how many, it's a vice, but mostly it's just it's all time sucks, time restrictions,
you know? Well, I mess up. You know, it's funny because I just make this big advocacy for maintaining coffee drinking as a vice.
Yeah.
But then I also have real trouble with sleep.
Oh,
so it could well be that I've like messed myself up. I know I'm like going to throw my coffee cup on the ground. It could be that I'm really messing myself up by I'm drinking too much coffee. It's hard for me to even like face that because I love coffee so much. So we're talking about drinking. Mm-hmm. Paul, mm-hmm. my spouse, is periodically he'll try to figure out how to make a drink, right? And I benefit from that.
Uh-huh.
But I really am a kind of one drink person. So
sure.
A recent drink that he learned how to make that I love is a pisco sour. Okay. It's very particular, and we had them. We were in Chile. We were doing, I did this Mind's Eye there, right? Mm-hmm. We had our very first Pisco Sour there, and it was outrageously delicious, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's this very particular thing where it's got like egg white in it, and it's so good. Mm. And then, we came back and it took Paul like a year and a half, I think, with tinkering to figure out how to make it. And finally,
this must be a hell of a pisco sour.
Well, it's like the balance of it, you know. And so every like couple of weeks, you try and make it again, and then but now he's like, yum. So you know, for me, that's like a nice thing. He'll make a drink, and it's very yummy, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, one thing that I quite like doing is sometimes I'll paint at night. And I'll have a glass of wine or a drink.
Yeah.
And then I drink very slowly, you know, so I can paint for a couple hours and while I'm sipping a drink.
Nice.
I think it's a nice thing. Right.
Anything you could share about that relationship? I'm always interested in artists who have partnered up with artists and just a nebulous conversation. I wouldn't even know where to start, but what's sharing your life with another creative? Not the same medium, but any stories from the road you could share?
Well,
or difficulties, challenges, you know?
It can be tricky in that potentially, you know, like you don't have one person who's going to make any big bucks. You don't have any guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the safety net because Paul was teaching. And so one of the things that allowed me to not teach was that he was teaching. So while I was making enough money to pay, you know, my share of the mortgage and all that, he had health insurance, right? And that things like that are really crucial.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
If both of us were in that zone where it was more precarious, I guess that would have made it trickier.
Mm.
There's also I suppose one complication, you know, if one person's kind of rolling career-wise and the other isn't, I suppose that can be tricky. Paul and I have, we've been relatively on par, not exactly, but, mm-hmm. Paul's, he has work as a photographer. Maybe it's easier to happen as a photographer. He has work in the collection of MoMA and the Met, mm-hmm. and the Art Institute of Chicago. I don't, right? Mm-hmm. But we both have gotten big grants. We both got Guggenheims, right? Mm-hmm. So, which sounds really impressive, but it's like, I don't even know what it means anymore, except that it bought me that year, and that was part of my leaving teaching and becoming an artist. That was like my seed money, was that grant. But because we both had these things happen, there wasn't that real imbalance, right? Mm. Which is good. But I think the much more important thing is that we both understand what motivates us.
Each other, or what motivates yourself individually?
I guess us. I'm saying like the royal us, like us artists.
Mm. Oh, okay. Right? All right, cool.
We both understand why an artist makes art.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people who've been in relationships where their spouse doesn't understand what a vocation is, and they don't really understand the commitment. I mean, I have a friend who was married, and the marriage no longer exists. I think that ended. And their spouse thought that her being an artist was a kind of groovy thing, you know, maybe a sexy thing, but didn't understand the depth of it, or how central it was, or how substantial it was, and how serious it was.
Yeah.
And never did. And it means, you know, they didn't understand something fundamental about her, which is why the marriage ended, right? Mm. So we understand that about ourselves, about each other, right? And that's a big deal, I think. It is a big deal to make your life around something that is a vocation, as opposed to, a smart career choice, but it's not part of who you are inside, you know? I mean, I can't even speak for what most jobs are, because I only know the way that I live my life, which is in this realm where what I do is a vocation. Mm-hmm. I remember being in therapy at one point and trying to explain what I was struggling with, and the therapist gave me this lecture about how I shouldn't make my work, I shouldn't define who I was based on how I was doing in work. You know, you need to feel good about yourself. And I thought, oh, you are the wrong therapist. I'm leaving you.
It's so funny. My friend has a good, made me chuckle when he said, I had to leave my therapist, or she stopped. He was looking for a new therapist. And he was like, not only is this hard, but I really don't want to have to explain to a therapist for the first 5 sessions what it is to be an artist, you know, because that is, I think, unless you just find the artist therapist, you do have to give them kind of a crash course in just what you're saying, the vocation of it, the sort of inevitable, I don't know, the part of it that is you, and make them kind of amend their suggestions.
I mean, some are more likely to understand it much more easily because they listen better. I can't speak for all therapists because my experience is very limited, mm-hmm. but it is a very particular set of decisions, because you make a choice to make your life about something that isn't actually guaranteed to earn you a living, and yet you're going to design your life around being able to do it.
Yeah,
and
right.
You know, and you get into day jobs and the like. I mean, we also both, Paul and I, are very lucky in that we both teach, and this is a big lucky thing. Mm. We both have full-time now tenured teaching jobs at schools that are just a few blocks from each other. Wow. Right. And so that is hugely fortunate, right? I mean, in so many ways, from like the small convenience and pleasure of being able to, you know, when our schedules line up, we can ride in together, you mm-hmm. know, to also, us both having right now, we've got a pretty equal balance in terms of our economic contribution. So, there's, I mean, that's, it's like a, it's more comfortable, you know. If, I mean, we've been in situations where I earned more and he earned less, and we're here and more and I earn less, but right now we're pretty nearly the same. It's comfortable. It's nice, you know.
But are you suggesting that, and I don't think you are, but I'm just curious to hear mm-hmm. your perspective, that if you have a relationship that is not so balanced, is it less sustainable, do you think? Or is it just more complicated to accept maybe a hierarchy? All these words sound incorrect, but because I understand what you're saying, and that equilibrium sounds fantastic, but I do think mm-hmm. it's pretty lucky to have such a situation.
No, we're totally lucky. Mm-hmm. I am not qualified to talk about what makes a relationship sustainable.
Yeah.
Like I can talk about our relationship, but the only thing I have that might be a word of wisdom that would relate to everyone is that it's mm-hmm. really hard to sustain a relationship. That's it.
Yeah. Period. I understand. It's
work. You know, you have to, it's work to work through issues and to work through, discord and disagreements. And it's work to maintain, you have to work at holding on to what really matters in it, and then there's a kind of day to day work that becomes a sort of expressions of respect, right? And you have to work at all that, because it's, you know, it's too easy to fall into patterns that actually can erode that. But I really don't know, you know, the big thing. I know that in our case, my husband's parents stayed married, you know, until they died. And in my case, my parents stayed married until my mother died. And my dad is soon to do that, too. Mm-hmm. And so that could be part of it, too, you know. I do think what I'm just expressing is luck. You know, we're lucky. We're lucky we both, I mean, we met teaching. You know, we both started teaching at the Maine College of Art at the exact same time. Okay. I was right out of grad school, and he was like 3 years out. And we met the first day in the very first faculty meeting, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we kind of moved. I mean, I left teaching for a bit. He's continued doing all along. But we can both talk about, like, we understand the frustrations of teaching. We're both on the same ridiculous academic schedule. It's mm-hmm. like we've been on it our whole lives now, right? And so, you know, our lives get to, you know, measure that kind of schedule. You know, I mentioned earlier, like, oh, this idea of kind of equal economic contribution. I want to say, I don't really think that matters. Mm. It only matters if if the couple thinks it matters. And so I could see how it could be a problem if one person says, well, you need to do more of this because I make more money. Like, that could be a problem.
Yeah.
I think what really matters is that you make sure that between the two of you, you make enough so that you can, you know, live life, you know. And, you know, I don't know that it necessarily matters who makes more, as long as you both respect that you're both contributing, right? Like, I mean, this also gets to my politics, but, I think, you know, if one person in a relationship stays home and, you know, focuses on, say, they're doing more of the child rearing for a while, mm-hmm. That's still very much labor, just because they don't make a paycheck from it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an equal contribution. You know, the other person might be earning the paycheck for a while. They're equal because mm-hmm. you're both contributing to this building a life together thing, right? It's not, yeah. And so that's it. I just think you have to look at it as a kind of, you each are doing whatever work you need to do to make your lives together work. And there's so many different ways to balance it.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah. What about, are you very involved in his art making, and is he in yours in the sense of critique and, you know, the fresh eye? I mean, does he know your work better than everyone and therefore you trust him implicitly? Or is there some other variation of that that I haven't said?
We have these different attitudes about it. He wants me to look at his work a lot. And I actually get grumpy about it. You know, like he'll want me to come to his studio where he'll put up all these work prints and he'll give me little post-its and I'm supposed to walk around and put a post-it on the ones that are like he'll have like five photographs of the same scenario, pick the best one. And then he'll get aggravated because I put up like three. He'll be like, what? Pick the one. I'm like, no, they're all good. And it's like, blah, blah, blah. But he wants that from me. Whereas I don't even want him to walk in here.
Like, interesting.
And I mean, every now and then I'll come in like with this painting, right? I was painting these tears over and over and over. I would paint them and take them away and paint them and take them away, trying to like invent tears. And then there was a point where I'm like, I think that might be it. And I ran out and got him. I said, just come out and tell me to stop. And he came out, looked at it and said, you're done. And then I, okay.
There you go.
But sometimes he drives me nuts. You know, he'll come in and tell me something and I'm very aggravated. I don't want him to tell me anything. So I'm grumpier about getting the feedback. It's very different, you know, personalities. I mean, there's also the fact that when he takes photographs, so much of that is a process that comes from, it's like editing down from the world. You know, you're, where are you pointing your camera? And then you're taking a whole lot of pictures. And then what are the pictures that you select? And then you select them down further and select them down further. But every picture is actually complete, right? Whereas in my case, like the work that's here is like some of it's done, but a lot of it is in progress. And when something is considered complete is a creative decision. And there can be this temptation. People come in here and they want to tell me, oh, it's done. Drives me nuts. It's like, don't say that to me, you know?
For sure.
And so, you know, he'll come in at times and say, don't touch it. And I will, just as sheer stubbornness, will go back into it. You know, I mean,
those are fighting words for me too. Yeah.
So anyway, we have different attitudes about it.
I see. What about, and this would be,
I should ask the one thing. We would never be together if we didn't respect each other's work. Like if I'd started seeing him and then I thought his work was mediocre,
yeah,
it wouldn't have lasted.
Interesting. Right?
I mean, I think that's crucial.
It is. That is crucial. Yeah. Because I can't imagine doing that either. If there's not,
like, how do you pretend that you respect their work?
I mean, you know, can do that for 6 months maybe, but, long term, there's not a chance. Tell me a little bit about that period of loneliness when you moved to Chicago. Many artists that I've talked to can relate to that. You move somewhere sort of not dependent on age, but probably as you get older, it does get more difficult. I'm asking that as a segue from the conversation about the relationship, because you were... You know, you did have a partner when you did this. At the same time, I've learned over the last couple of years that just having a partner doesn't mean you don't feel all different kinds of lonely, especially as an artist. And it's therefore up to you to build what you need and not be reliant on this partner who's probably trying to, you know, that's dependency or so on. Maybe you could just speak a little bit about that period. And I know you already have, and it was a trying time between the galleries and your mother passing. But yeah, how do you think about loneliness and community and relying on your partner, but not necessarily to fill all of that, you know, check all of those boxes for you?
Well, let's see. First, I mean, I'm kind of an introvert, right? And I fake extroversion when I'm teaching, but I'm really at heart not at all. And when we were living in Maine, and we were there for 13 years. I mean, there was sort of a year where I tried when I was teaching at BU to, we tried having an apartment in Boston, but then realized we'd rather have me commute from Portland than have Paul commute to Portland from Boston. So we chose to do that. But I really loved living in Maine. And I think it's probably like the perfect size for me. And somehow the community was just the right, I don't know what it was, but it was, I didn't have to work at becoming part of a community. I was teaching, mm-hmm. which was automatically, there was that connection. And, yeah. and then, when I was painting, and this is like a, I suppose career-wise, it's a funny bounce back in Maine. If you start showing someplace else that like I started showing in Boston, it was like I might as well have been showing in Maine. Suddenly everybody knew my work in Maine, even though I was showing in Boston. You know, if I, when I began to show in New York, I mean, right now I'm really not showing in New York anymore. But when I began to show in New York, suddenly everybody knew my work even more in Maine. You know, so it was this thing where I didn't have to do any of that work. I just was teaching and I made my paintings. And like when I got this gallery in Boston, that was so wonderful. It was cause I had a good painting in a faculty show and they saw it, you know, and I just, things happened because I had work on the wall and somebody saw it. And I came to know other artists just by being in the world, you know, and I'd meet artists through teaching. I'd meet artists through, you know, going to see a show or whatever. But it was, I didn't have to do any work. It just happened, like the way you meet people when you're in school or something, right? And I could be very introverted, and yet I could still meet people because the other things I was doing took me out. So then when we move here and I'm in a community that's, really, it's centered around schools. Like everybody goes to Chicago to go to work, and I'm working from my house, and I'm not meeting other artists. I'm meeting, you know, parents, right? And I've got Jennifer, who you met, who's here, and Jennifer, you know, is a lot of things. One of the things that she is an artist. But she's in a very different circle from, say, the people who are at the Art Institute, right? And she's in this, like, local self-taught, like, and she's also really just kind of wildness, you know, and also doing...
She's into acting. She's an actor
She is an actress. I mean, yeah. That was her living for a long time, and she still acts. But, in fact, the first time I ever saw her was way before I met her, because I saw her in a Sprint commercial.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 10 cent a minute. And she was like super charming. I remember watching this when I was, you know, I hadn't yet met Paul. And I remember seeing this commercial thinking, wow, she's cute. That was Jennifer. So if you ever see this really old commercial where this young woman's looking at the camera and saying, you know, now I can call my parents anytime I, you know, how was it? I can tell them everything, the 10 cent a minute thing. And then she gets this wicked smile and goes, well, not everything. But anyway, that's Jennifer. So, I met her, but she was part of this world that was a world of parents and a world of volunteers with this art center. And then, a world of, and then her own self, which was like the center of her world, because she's like very much unlike me. Like she builds a community everywhere she goes, and so I was pulled into that, you know. But it wasn't in this kind of context where people first knew me as this artist. Everybody first knew me as this mom, right? Who was here, who was also an artist, you know. But it was a very different way of knowing. And I wasn't meeting my direct peers in terms of having this particular vocation, right? And I didn't even anticipate how lonely that would make me, right? That I wasn't in that world anymore. And so, yeah, that was And it had a lot of, it had a real effect on me. I was able to, you know, begin to find that again in a different way when I started teaching at the School of the Art Institute, because it is this kind of center again. I didn't find it the same way I did in Maine, because I came to Chicago. I already would have been defined as mid-career. I mean, I guess I was 39, right? Or, but I already had a gallery, and I didn't make enough work to look for something in Chicago, and I wasn't known in Chicago. So it was very complicated for me. Like, how do I make myself known here as an artist when I can't really introduce my work and have my work, you know, at the very beginning, right? And I don't know that I did that so well. I basically introduced myself as a teacher and then as a curator, you know, the head of the chair of the exhibition committee at the Riverside Arts Center. And I was known in that regard. And it was like my work was going elsewhere. And it was sort of strange, but I was certainly part of this conversation, but not so much because my work was being put into Chicago.
You had a different role, or you had taken on different roles, it sounds like.
Yeah. And then I would be told, like, you don't need to show in Chicago because you're already showing here. And I'm like, yeah, I think maybe you sort of do. But, I mean, I've shown work in Chicago, mm-hmm. and people know my work, but they often, like, they don't get much of a chance to see it. And, you know, I do have something, I'm not sure when it's going to be, but I think I'm going to be in a two-person show that's coming up, and so I'll get to show in Chicago again, mm-hmm. but I don't do it all that often, mm-hmm. right?
We've talked about your studio practice before in terms of the finite amount of time and the chipping away at the ideal amount of time, but I'm not sure if we've talked about blockages yet. And I wonder during this period, again, sorry to keep going back to this, we can talk about any other time that we could use as an example. But when you are in a space like this of discomfort, maybe general discomfort, does it impact your studio in a way? And is it common for you to get into the studio in these precious hours that you have and not work, and, you know, it all freezes or stops?
I view time in the studio, whether you're making marks on the surface or just looking at the paintings, it's all work. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in the studio, I'm working.
Got it.
I mean, sometimes I'll nap. Mm-hmm. I still think of that as working because I wake up and I'm looking at the paintings, right?
Sure.
So, if I'm getting in, I'm going to find that momentum.
Okay.
So the problem is when things keep me from getting in.
Yeah.
Right. And I get stuck when I'm not working, and it's a weird circle, right? Mm-hmm. That's what happens. There are things that can cause me not to work. Right now, it's literally other things that are... I mean, I'm not actually stuck in that I'm looking at paintings that I think are really interesting. I just need to get to work on them. But I know because I haven't been in the studio because of this other show, mm-hmm. which is a very good show, by the way. Mm-hmm. but this other show that's up is took so much time. I haven't been in here painting for a couple weeks, right? Mm. And so I know it's going to take me a little revving up. Like I might end up painting and then I might wipe it all away. It'll take me a little while to get into the groove of the painting, but it'll still feel productive.
Yeah.
Because I've got these paintings that are ongoing and they're interesting to me, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not actually stuck right now in terms of my work mm-hmm. itself. I'm stuck in terms of my feeling of well-being, because when I'm not in the studio, I start to feel miserable.
Yeah.
Like, for the reasons that we talked about.
So you support the studio nap and the studio sitting in the chair.
Yeah.
And the idea that all you need is enough time to have that be the state. And I totally get it. But How do you feel about the word procrastination? Like, is that an evil word? Do you not believe in it? Did you feel differently about it at a certain point in your career or your practice? What's that word about?
I will procrastinate coming out to the studio because I'm struggling with other crap.
Yep.
And it's like a bizarre thing where I will use... The problem is, okay, if I have things that are stressing me out, I can't focus in the studio. And so I will often be procrastinating dealing with the stuff that stresses me out, but I can't be in the studio because I can't focus on that when I'm stressed by something. So I'll have something else that I'm doing to avoid the things that stress me out.
Sure.
And then I'm still not getting in the studio. It's like a ridiculous
thing.
That's
when I clean my house.
Right?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And that's when I'm like doing like a spelling bee, New York Times or something. When I should really only do that on the train, right? But I'll be like doing it when I should be out here. So I can procrastinate in a ludicrous way. Mm-hmm. If I'm on a roll, I'm not procrastinating. I get my ass out and I get to work because I really want to.
Got it.
But that has to do with momentum. And yeah. Momentum can be propelling you forward, and it can also be keeping you still. And so if I have a momentum that is a procrastination momentum, I would like to think that I could be such a grown-up and be so disciplined about this. But that discipline happens only when I get the momentum that gets me steady in the computer computer is something. Paul would be like, hello, Ann, the computer. So that's one of the things I can really use to, like, I'll get on it because I'm procrastinating doing something else. And the tricky thing, of course, is that you have to get on it because I have all these emails I have to answer from work or I'm supposed to post about this show that we just did on social media, which I haven't done, all that stuff. And then suddenly I go down a well of distraction with that. And that too is another kind of procrastination.
I love, I have to point out the irony of it, that you wish you could be a grown up in the studio when it is exactly all of the grown up stuff that disallows you from being able to access the studio. I think that's, and forever, I feel that way too. What about the other word that, keeps me up at night, inspiration? On the days when there is no procrastination, when you're in that space, and I know we talked about momentum, which maybe substitutes for inspiration, but maybe not. Do you think that there is something like that, that comes and goes, or are you more the type of artist who says, nope, it's just about, it's 10,000 hours, it's you in the studio, it's a routine, and it's, that other stuff is a little flowery?
I think the word inspiration just sounds really kind of squishy. Mm-hmm. It implies that creativity is something that just happens because you have this flash and then suddenly you're all inspired. And I really do think that it comes from working, and I know there's some good quotes about this. I think Picasso has something to say about, inspiration happens while you're working. I don't know what the exact quote is. Mm-hmm. Chuck Close says something like, inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just get to work. Mm. I think, though, there is another thing which I refer to as the zone, which is a certain kind of concentration that's, I think, writers have to be in it. Mm. I think athletes, when they're on a roll, are in it. And it's a certain kind of intuitive, everything is connecting and you're just sort of in the middle of the work and working.
Yeah.
And that is something that's generated through working and reaching a point where you find that role. It doesn't happen through waiting for a good idea to come along. But it is a kind of fluency and a fluidity, a way of working that is very special. And that is not, that comes from working, but it's not guaranteed. Like, I'll come in and some days I'm not going to get there. And I, I might, everything I do at the end of the day, I might wipe it off, or the next morning I might wipe it off. But still, I know that that day that was like a kind of a clunker, I had to do that for whatever reason to get to maybe the next day where it wasn't a clunker, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think you have to be, you have to be in the studio. And people will say, what inspires you? It's like, I mean, I love painting. I love all kinds of things. You know, I love, you know, there's certain books that I love. You know, there's certain, there are all kinds of different things that I love. But the thing that makes my, that's all stuff that has to do with me developing as a, you know, developing as an artist by looking at art, you know, and the like. But this idea of inspiration, like somehow a light bulb will go on and you'll just suddenly jump in and get to work. It's like, it's better if you just work and the light bulb will go on while you're working, I think.
When you're talking about the zone, or when you're talking about the other space that exists in here, do you believe that you, do you prefer being extremely present with the process of painting, or do you prefer to be maybe half distracted by, you know, so many artists listen to podcasts or music or the news? Do you recognize that your brain is working differently in those two different states? And then do you prefer one all the time, some of the times? Is it a mood thing?
Yeah, I tend to listen. That's such an interesting question, because I know there was a period of my life where I think I painted in quiet. Mm. And then there was a period where I would paint with music going. Mm. And then there was a period where I realized the music was distracting me. Like it would, suddenly a song would go on that I didn't like, and then that distracted me. Or it came on and I really liked it, and I was dancing around the studio and not painting. Mm-hmm. And then there was a long period where I realized the counter to that, I discovered NPR. We lived in Maine. I remember finding in my studio, I started listening to public radio, and my day, how did this work? There were these two shows, just the way it was timed, like Fresh Air was on in the morning, and then at the end of the day was All Things Considered. I remember having like this kind of parenthetical thing of these two shows. That was my studio day. And I would get in so I could hear Fresh Air. And then, you know, at the end of All Things Considered, I would go home, right? And that held me, that kind of listening to, it was that kind of thing where you're hearing stuff. It matters, but you can also tune it out. It's like somehow, it was a certain kind of concentration where I could be completely in my thing with painting, but this story is unfolding, and sometimes it would sink in, sometimes it wouldn't.
Yeah.
And then the 2016 election happened, and it was so stressful. I couldn't listen to NPR anymore. I would actually get angry. I started getting angry at news sources that I had always read, like, or listened to, because I was suddenly hearing all this bias, and all, and everything was stressing me out. And And I had to turn off NPR. And I had this period of like, oh no, now what?
You lost your magic feather.
Right? You know? And so I started listening to books on tape. Mm. And so now I listen to a kind of combination. Sometimes I'll turn to NPR, but I often will listen. Like before you came, I was listening to Agatha Christie, Miss Marple short stories.
For sure.
That's, you know, and I listened to there, a lot of these like old favorites, like from back when I was a kid, right? Because I know the stories, right? So if something happens and I miss it because I'm focused on painting, it's not like I'm lost.
Yeah.
But they're actually really good, you know? Yeah. So it's not like the crappiness of it brings me down, right? And so like before this, I was listening to that whole James Herriot, you know, All Creatures Great and Small. Oh, those are really fun.
I'm going to look into it.
Yeah. He was a country vet in England, and he wrote just the, you know, multiple books that are just about different, you know, experiences he had. Like the very first story begins with him up to his shoulder inside a cow helping him have a baby. Right? You know, so anyway, I listen to that, right? So I have these books on tape.
And how do you feel about silence now in the studio? You prefer what you just described, but have you gone, does it make you uncomfortable? Because I find a little bit of discomfort that I'm trying to push through, because I, I, I'm at least, my hypothesis is that my brain does work differently when I have something mm-hmm. in the background, sort of what you described, a half narrative I can go in and out of. But that if I'm just faced with me and the image, mm-hmm. that my problem solving might be different. So I'm actually trying to go back into it. And I'm wondering, do you feel comfortable in silence these days? Or
sometimes I will realize, oh, I'm painting in silence. But usually if I'm starting, the first thing I do is I turn on whatever it is I'm going to listen to.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
I turn it on and I'm setting up my palette. So if there's a ritual, it's, you know, so you'll see my palette. I set up my palette and then moved it back, right? But while I was setting up my palette and getting myself set up, I had, so that's my thing. So it's like I've started, it's on, right? And so I guess that matters, right? Sometimes I'll find myself working in silence because I'm kind of on a roll, and whatever it was I was listening to runs out, and I
that
keep painting.
That happens to me. Mm-hmm,
right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I should tell you another thing I've listened to, but I like listened all the way through it, and then periodically I'll go back and start it over. But there's this history podcast called Hardcore History.
Oh, sure, with Dan Harmon.
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and so I've like, it's like this kind of, because he's such a nerd, right? Uh-huh. And he's just like this little boy. And I've listened to him talk about the Mongols repeatedly.
Well, that's an easy thing to get lost in too, for sure. Also, my only problem with that is acknowledging now in my 30s that I am fairly sensitive. When it becomes, you know, and then he ate his son. And of course, after that, he ate his son. And you're hearing all of this, like, violence and just, you know, all of this stuff. It can become a little bit...
So when did... That sounds like a Zeus. When did, who ate whose son in day?
It was, Carlin's, I think we were talking about, it was one of those many like Persian battles, and it was talking about the, you know, just those, but it does, you're right. It sounds like something out of Herodotus or something, where it's like, you know.
So I have to admit that somehow I'm able to just skim right through those.
There you go.
Right. And it's that's funny, you know. Those don't distract me. I get much, I was, as opposed to the politics of the stuff that was immediately around me.
Yeah,
that was so stressful and distracting. Like I would start yelling at the radio. You know, it was ridiculous. I could not work, and so but the history thing, I love them. I really love those. And my son turned me onto them.
Onto Hardcore History.
He said, Mom, you're going to love this. And he was so right.
I might end with this question, and maybe it's not a good question to end with, but when we're talking about the politics of our time and how the world's working, and you have this great space out here, and you know, you choose when the radio goes on and when to turn it off. You know, there's that idea, which I think is romantic and kind of squishy too, which is that as creative people, there is some sort of responsibility to be dealing with what's going on in the world, which I don't believe in, or if I do believe in it, it is in a very indirect way in the filter of the filter of the filter.
Yeah.
But in a time of heavily politicized everything, including art, do you, which you could maybe say is a trend and it will last as long as it lasts. Do you know that pushback where maybe someone has asked you why your work isn't not more of the time, but more, less of a subtle touch, like more direct about something topical? And then how do you respond? And, you know, I think this might be a meager question because it's like we all know the answer, which is that we all care, but our vocation is one that, you know, if we all just spend our time in the studio drawing and painting about what's going on right now, I think we'd all end up underground.
You know, during the pandemic, right, and then when the Black Lives Matter, you know, Floyd was murdered, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know the? It's a kind of a, I don't know how it's defined. It's not really a blog. It's like a series of articles. But there's a. It's called Painters on Paintings.
Yeah, I think I do know that.
And they'll ask artists to talk about, they'll ask painters to talk about a painting they love. And I wrote, very early on, I wrote about one of my favorite paintings in the Art Institute, Dirk Boots, the Mater Della Rosa. And then they asked artists again during the pandemic to write about what we were looking at now during the pandemic. And I tried to write about this thing, right? Because I was supposed to be on sabbatical. I got completely distracted by the politics. Like we were going out, you know,
and your sabbatical year was
or sabbatical semester.
Right.
And I was like going out and we were going to Black Lives Matter protests, you know. It was like a kind of wild sense of responsibility that just felt like I'm so the election's happening and this is happening and I remember feeling like if I stop paying attention, the world's going to fall over a cliff. But I can't pay attention in my studio the way I'm supposed to. And I wrote about it by writing about two different artists. And I talked about, I was comparing Janice Nowinski to Peter Williams, mm-hmm. you know, who you're looking at now. And I own a little painting by Janice because I curated a show of her work at the Riverside Arts Center. And I had the painting up in my studio. And then I was looking at Peter Williams because, he knew artists that I knew. And so I had seen his work years earlier in the Whitney Biennial around 2000, but I started looking at his work much harder because I knew he was close with them. And then we wound up, he and I, talking on Facebook, right? On social media. And, I really liked him on social media. And we would have, and some of the conversations were about art, but some were about painting, right? About politics. And his work was really amazing. And he died like a year or two after this. But I was thinking about his work and I was thinking about her work. And I began to think about her work as the private and his work as the public. And then I was thinking about this dilemma I was having, which was how hard it was for me to focus in this private space I needed to be in, this kind mm-hmm. of zone of concentration when this stuff was happening publicly. Yeah. And it really did a number. Like I did not use my sabbatical the way I was supposed to. Mm. And so I tried to write about that. So, I mean, for me, like I can't do, it would be bullshit if I just said, well, I'm politically aware. So now I'm going to make work about this. It's like, your work is not something that turns on a dime. I mean, there are people who maybe, their work, that is what matters to them. And that's sure. what they do.
Political arts. Yeah.
They could, the danger is their work can be really superficial. It could function as a poster, right? There are artists who can make work that is political and that work has depth. Peter Williams is one of them. Mm. Goya is another. Carr Walker is another. There are artists who do that, right? Yeah. And their work, that layer that is political, is an entry point, right? I guess just to say something sort of big about art. And about artists, we all exist in the world in layers, and we all have a political layer, and we all have a private layer. And I exist in my community. I mean, I am in my home, you know, and it's personal in my home, my little private world, right? And then I'm also a member of a community. I go out in the world. I teach. I have also political opinions. Mm-hmm. I exist as somebody who votes. You know, in the 2020 election, I was mad about Elizabeth Warren, you know, mm-hmm. You know, there's, I mean, I exist on that level. Right.
Yeah.
And my work as well exists that way. We all exist that way, but how we enter our work, it can exist at different points in that layering. And for some of us, we enter our work privately. Some of us enter the work publicly. My opinion, I do think there's such a thing as great work. And I think great work is not superficial. It doesn't only exist as one layer, right? Work that is made very privately still can be understood politically in the world, you know?
I agree.
And so you could talk about my work in that context. That's not how I think about it when I'm painting. That doesn't mean that, I mean, again, I talk about meaning. It comes from the people who are outside the work interacting with it. So I'm not going to tell somebody they're wrong if they decided to talk about my work in the context of, say, feminism, right? Which I'm a feminist. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. I don't think feminism with every mark I make, and yet that's in there. So I'm giving you this example because when I wrote this thing about, I talked about Peter and Janice's work, and then I sent it to Peter. And I included was an image of that painting, a little baby, which I was almost done with. Because we had to have, I was showing their work and Janice's work, Peter's work, and then also work that I was thinking of in relationship to Peter's work. And then I was supposed to include one piece of my own, so I included that. And Peter's take on this painting was that it was about white fragility. And I was sort of stunned. And then I thought, well, of course, that's his point of view. Mm. And he meant it it was good. Like, he meant it as a good thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking about it as I want to make it about birth and mortality, you know, and that's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. And he saw it in the context of race. And fragility, and I was like, wow. And I was sort of taken aback and then also kind of amazed. And I didn't know exactly what to do with it, but I have to accept it, right? There it is. Anyway.
It's so interesting. And I've had such a great time talking to you. And
you.
I just want to thank you again for inviting me over. And yeah, this has just been a great visit, so... Thanks for being on Art Matters.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. Thank you for asking me.
And that was the conclusion of my conversation with the artist Anne Harris. If you'd like to find out more about her work, check out the links in the episode description and find her website at anneharrispainting.com. For those of you listening, as this episode releases, Anne has two shows opening next month, a two-person show in Chicago with Stasius Gallery and Serious Topics Gallery in LA. This one is called Anne Harris WIP. As always, you can check me out and listen to older episodes of Art Matters at isaacmann.com. That's spelled with two A's and two N's. If you have any questions about the podcast, drop me a line at artmatterspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening to Art Matters. If you have a moment, please consider leaving a review or sharing on social media. All of that helps get this project into more ears, which is a good thing. New episodes of Art Matters, the podcast for artists, drop every other Thursday. See you next time.